We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s. We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers the ballads, the rock tunes, the songs we all dance to, the girl groups and boy groups, solos and doo-wop. He talks to the stars of the stage shows and sock hops. We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
And honey, I miss you. And I'm being good. And I'd love to be with you if only I could.
I'm Ronnie Allen. All of you know that Bobby Goldsboro is an accomplished pop singer and songwriter. What some of you may not know is that he's also an accomplished painter and television producer. And we're going to be discussing all of that and much, much more as we take a walk down memory lane with my guest of honor today. Bobby is on the phone with me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We have talked before, so this is not the first time I've done an interview with you, and I can tell my audience that this guy is one of the most interesting people I've ever interviewed. In fact, just to prove that, I'm going to ask you, could you do a ribbit right off the top of your head right now?
Now, you know what? Most people, believe it or not, they say, let me hear the cricket noise, but it's really a tree frog. But probably 90% of the people come up and say, let me hear the cricket, so I do the, and they say, that's it.
That's incredible. 1,000 years from now, when people talk about your career, most people will be talking about a song called Honey.
That's true.
For better or for worse, and I'm sure you're fully aware that not only was that an incredibly popular song and an incredibly popular recording, but possibly because it gets played so often, there are some people who love it and there are some people who don't love it.
Well, it's odd. There's several sites on the internet. They listed top 10 greatest songs of all times, and Honey is in there. And then another list has the top 10 worst songs ever recorded, and Honey's in that top 10. So it's one of those you either love it or hate it.
You got it covered, and it was written by Bobby Russell.
Correct.
It was sung by Bobby Goldsboro, and it was produced by Bobby Montgomery.
Yeah, actually, Bob and I co-produced it. Bob had come to Nashville to take over A&R duties for United Artists, and I was with United Artists, and we just kind of hit it off, and I asked him if he'd like to co-produce with me, and that was one of the first things we did together.
My point here is that if your name wasn't Bobby, you need not apply for that record. Interestingly, when people associate you with that song, which was a tearjerker, what many people may not be aware of is the fact that your very first hit single was also a tearjerker, even though it didn't involve a death. And before we get to that and we talk about Molly, let me just ask you a little bit of basic information. You were born in Florida, I believe.
Marianna, Florida, which is in northwest Florida.
And you then moved to Alabama.
I moved there in the ninth grade and graduated from high school in Dothan, Alabama. And that's when I actually got into a little rock and roll band called The Web, W-E-B-S, like spider webs. And
okay.
We were really cool. We had black shirts, black pants and white ties with a black spider tie pin.
What kind of music were you...
We were playing whatever was popular. We did everything from the current pop hits that was out there, rock and roll. We did rhythm and blues. And we played a lot of college fraternities and sororities at Auburn University, University of Alabama, Florida
okay.
State, places like that. Whatever they wanted, we would work up. And they'd call and say, can you play so-and-so? And we'd say, oh, yeah. And then we'd work it up after we told them we could. So we'd get the job. But we played whatever was currently hot. We would play it. And I grew up listening to everybody from John Lee Hooker and Lightnin' Hopkins, Lightnin' Slim, the blues guys, to when Elvis and Rick Nelson and everybody came along, I started learning those things. That's one reason I think over the years my songwriting has varied, because I never grew up listening to one kind of music. There was only one station in Marianna. They played everything. Growing up, I didn't know there was a difference in country music and pop music and gospel music. I thought it was all just music.
We're talking like around 1956, right?
Yeah. I moved into Dothan, Alabama around 56, and so 57, 58, and 59, I was going to Dothan High, and my senior year is when I got into the band with the Webs, and then my freshman year at Auburn, is where we really kind of started deciding that's what we wanted to do.
Did you have this dream of becoming a major recording star at that point?
Not really. At that point, I still wanted to play second base for the Cleveland Indians. I don't know why I picked Cleveland, but I think growing up, I liked the little Indian logo they had.
Why second base?
I grew up in Little League and Pony League. I was a pitcher, and I did great. In fact, I still have some records in Mariana, Florida, in Little League pitching records. But the thing is, by the time I got into my teens, everybody else kind of grew up and I stayed the same size. And I was still throwing at the same speed, and the mound was moved further back in high school, and my pitch was still going the same speed, and it took longer to get to the plate. And I love to hit anyway. I always played second base when I wasn't pitching. I just stuck to second base.
You worked with Roy Orbison for some time, didn't you?
Yeah, Roy did more for me than probably anybody. Our band, the Webs, like I said, we were going to Auburn University, and we were hired to back up Roy for four nights because he had just fired his band. He found out they were drinking or something, and he didn't allow any of that kind of stuff. So he was looking for a band in the area, and it wasn't that we were that good. We were just the only band around. So we were hired to back up Orbison, and we were blown away that we were going to get to work with him. So we worked up his songs as best four guys could, you know, because he had the big arrangements, big orchestrated arrangements. But we just really hit it off, and after the first night, Roy and I just were like old friends, and by the end of the fourth night, we were like brothers, and he asked us if we'd like to go on the road as his band, and we became the Roy Orbison Band, and I traveled with Roy for 3 years. He and I would room together, we'd fly together. It was just like two brothers just having a ball on the road.
What was Roy like off stage?
He was a great guy and a funny guy. A lot of people didn't realize that he had a great sense of humor because on stage he was very serious and he didn't do much talking in between songs. He'd just stand there and hit those high notes and just blow everybody away. But he was really a funny guy.
And of course the reason you got the job was not just that you were good, but you were also sober.
Well, true. That had a lot to do with it. The thing is, the greatest thing was I would sing harmony with Roy on all the songs. So I'm up there in front of 10, 15, 20,000 people a night, and they weren't looking at me. They were looking at Roy, but I was up there and got used to performing in front of large crowds and things like that. So it helped me tremendously. Plus the fact that Roy had so many really great chord changes in his songs, chords that I'd never played before, and I had to learn them. And so I started using those in my songwriting and all. So he just helped me tremendously.
I'm Ronnie Allen, and I'm so pleased to be talking to one of my rock and roll heroes, Mr. Bobby Goldsboro. Not all of your songs are considered really rock and roll, but we could consider you rock and roll when you do a thing like Little Things and stuff like that. We could probably do a mini-series on you, but we're restricted to a one-hour show here, so right now we're going to get moving, and we're going to go through a lot of your hit records, and you had plenty of those. And the very first one came in the year 1962, and the song was called Molly. And how did that come about?
Well, actually, I had signed a recording contract with a guy named Jack Gold, who later on became head of A&R for United Artists, and then for, I think, CBS. Jack Gold heard some tapes we'd made up in Alabama and signed me to a recording contract, and then I didn't hear from him for a year. In the meantime, we had gotten with Orbison, we're on the road as the Roy Orbison Band, and I figured that was a short career. I never heard from him again. And about a year later, he called me and said, I finally found a hit song for you, and it's called Molly. I'm going to send it to you and bring you to New York to record you. And I'm thinking, wow, New York. I've never been out of Alabama, much less going to New York. So he sent me the song, and I hated it, mainly because it had a recitation in there, and I felt like I sounded like I was 9 years old, and I'm supposed to sound like a soldier coming back from the war. So I really didn't like the song, but I wasn't about to tell him I didn't like it, or he wouldn't record me. So I went to New York and recorded the song, and it came out, and I never left Orbison during the entire time the record was out. I did one record hop in Nashville, Tennessee, and did it live, and I said, I'll never do this song again.
Apart from having to do a recitation, how did you feel about the song itself? It's kind of a downer, isn't it?
It really was. The story was that it was a soldier who came back from the war, and he was blind, and he couldn't see his son, and Molly was his wife, and it was just a really sad, downer song, like you say, and I was thinking, man, I wanted to do rock and roll, and he found this ballad for me to do. I never really liked it the whole time. In fact, we were on stage with Orbison in Houston, Texas, and Roy had the place packed, and in between songs, they were hollering something, the crowd was, and it turns out, we finally figured out they were hollering Molly, and it turns out Molly was number one in Houston. And Roy said, are you going to sing Molly? I said, there's no way. I said, I'll never sing that. So we just ignored it, and he went on and did his show.
We're going to listen to it right now. This is Bobby Goldsboro and his first hit single called Molly.
The war began and Henry left his farm, left his darling Molly with a baby in her arms. Now the war was over and their life could begin. Molly saw her darling standing at the door again. It's so nice to hear your voice again, Molly. So nice to feel your arms around me, Molly. Oh, how happy I'd be if I only could see you, sweet, sweet Molly. Please don't cry. Maybe I should have written to let you know ahead of time, but I was afraid you'd worry if you knew that I'd gone blind. Do I hear you crying, Molly? Please don't cry, you silly thing. See what you've done. You've even brought a tear to my eye. Oh, how happy I'd be if I only could see you, sweet, sweet Molly. Please don't cry. Where's my son? What does he look like, Molly? Everyone says he took after me. Lord, I wish I could see. Come here, little man. Don't be afraid. I'm your daddy. Guess he'll get used to me in time. Won't he, Molly? It's so nice to hear your voice again, Molly. So nice to feel your arms around me, Molly. Oh, how happy I'd be if I only could see you, sweet, sweet Molly. Please don't cry. Please don't cry.
What label was that on?
Laurie Records, which is no longer in existence. I get emails a lot of times, people want to know where they can find Molly, and I said, I have no idea because I don't know who owns the master or anything. I know it's out there somewhere because occasionally I'll get a copy of it sent in the mail for me to sign. It's funny, I hear that song and it sounds like I'm 9 years old.
Right. Have you gotten to like it over the years, or do you still feel the same way?
I don't dislike it as much as I did, but I still, at that period, I was wanting to sing rock and roll, though, and I never thought about singing ballads that much. When I first went out on my own after I left Orbison, the first concert tour I did, I was the opening act for the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
I was doing just rock and roll then.
Speaking of rock and roll, we now get to a song called See the Funny Little Clown. Now, that's not exactly rock and roll. It's a ballad. And See the Funny Little Clown became a top 10 hit.
It was one of the first songs that I wrote for myself. I'd been writing for the band and things like that when we started out, and after I got with Orbison, we were writing together for a while, Roy and I were, but when Jack Gold was going to bring me to New York to record after Molly, we were going to cut an album, and he had three songs picked that I was going to record, and when he sent them to me, not that I thought the songs were bad, I just thought they didn't sound like hits to me, but again, I'm thinking, well, he's the record producer, he knows more about it than I do, but I said to myself, I said, I think I can write something this good, so in about 20 minutes, I wrote See the Funny Little Clown, and as I was halfway through it, I already felt like, I said, I think this could really be a hit, so I brought it up to New York, and Jack Gold played it for him, and he said, well, back then you would do a three-hour recording session.
Right.
You did as many songs as you could in the 3 hours, and we usually got three songs done. And we finished, had about 15 minutes left, and he said, well, we've got time. Let's do that fourth song, that song you wrote, Cold Feet on a Little Clown. We did it in 15 minutes.
It became your first top 10 hit.
See the funny little clown, see him laughing as you walk by. Everybody thinks he's happy 'cause you never see a tear in his eye. No one knows he's crying, no one knows he's dying on the inside. He's laughing on the outside. no one knows. No one knows. See the funny little clown, he's hiding behind a smile. They all think he's laughing, but I know he's really crying all the while. How his heart is aching, how his heart is breaking on the inside. But he keeps laughing on the outside. No one knows.
No one knows.
No one knows. This funny little clown, you never used to see him around without his girl beside him to love and guide him. Until one day his girl just walked away, and to this very day he says he never loved her anyway. Because you see,
no one knows.
I'm that funny little clown. See the funny little clown.
See the funny little clown, Bobby Goldsboro. I am Ronnie Allen, so pleased to be talking with Bobby. While See the Funny Little Clown was moving up the chart, you were doing a certain amount of promoting. You were going from place to place, and you had a little bit of an incident in a plane.
I was with Lou Christie and Diane Renee, and we were going to do a record hop. And we had to fly from Pittsburgh to Wheeling, West Virginia. And there was like a blizzard outside as we're driving out to the airport. I'd only been on a couple of planes in my life, and that was with Orbison. And I'm thinking, man, I just don't like airplanes to begin with. And hopefully this is going to be a nice plane we're getting in, or we'll get out to the airport and they'll say it's snowing too hard, we're not going to go. Well, we got out to the airport, and I look across the runway, and here's all these nice planes. I saw this little tiny plane sitting over there. I'm thinking, thank goodness we're not getting on that one. And it turns out that's the one we were getting on. It was a little single-engine plane, and the disc jockeys owned the plane with Bob Tracy and Clark Grace. And Bob Tracy was the pilot. So we get in the plane, and they sat up front, the pilot, co-pilot. Diane and Lou sat in the two seats, and I was in back behind them. There was no seat. I had to get climbed in the back and just kind of ball up there in the back of the plane. And it's snowing so hard you can barely see out there, and I'm thinking, if I had any sense, I'd say, I'm not going to do this, but I said to myself, they won't play my records anymore. At the time, that was more important than my life, I guess. So we got on this plane and took off, and we hadn't been in the air 15 minutes when the plane started having problems, and the engine was almost cutting out. The oil line had burst on the plane, and we were coming down without wanting to. And the pilot was hollering, Mayday, Mayday. He was panicking. So we could see the light on the plane was hitting the tops of the trees, and we were prepared for impact.
Well, I recently spoke with Diane Renee, and she had her own memories of this particular event, including what you were doing, Bobby, when this was taking place.
I saw my whole life go before my eyes. I mean, I just thought that this is it. This is it. Another Buddy Holly, Big Bopper, Patsy Cline thing. And I'm squeezing my arms around Lou Christie's arm and praying like, oh, my God. And Lou Christie's praying. And then Bobby Goldsboro in the back, he was a real sweetheart, but was a practical joker, and he's saying, just think of it, we're all going to have memorial albums out. Ribbit, ribbit. But I just turned my head around, and I yelled at him, shut up!
Fortunately, you landed safely, so the story does have a happy ending.
We made it to this little airport somewhere in West Virginia, and we hit the runway like three times the speed you're supposed to because the flaps weren't even working on the plane, and we taxied around about six times till the plane finally stopped, and we got off, and I mean, we pulled up, and everything just stopped, and there was silence on the plane for about 10 seconds at least. Nobody could speak, and then the pilot turned around and said, I think I know the problem. I think I can fix this, and we can go, and I'm thinking, I was already getting off, and we were all climbing out like this, and no way on earth we'll ever get back on this thing. You know, we ended up taking a cab to the record, and we actually made it to the record hop on time.
Finally, in 1964, Mr. Goldsboro has a rock and roll hit, because Little Things, that's rock and roll.
It is. I had already written the song, and Roy Orbison called me and said he's just cut the best record he ever cut, and he played it for me, Pretty Woman. And I said, man, I love it. In fact, I just wrote a song called Little Things. I said, you know what? I love that 4-4 beat, because I had a 2-4 beat on mine, you know, the doom, doom, doom.
Right.
I said, I'm recording this in a couple of weeks. I said, I'm going to put that beat. He says, go ahead, because I think this is going to be the biggest record I ever had, and it turned out to be his biggest record. So had he not written Pretty Woman, Little Things with the same beat might not have been on there. So everything happens for a reason.
Little things that you do make me glad I'm in love with you. Little things that you say make me glad that I feel this way. The way you smile, the way you hold my hand, and when I'm down, you always understand. You know I love those little things in my ear that you say when there's no one here. Little things that you do let me know that your love is true. When we walk, you like to hold my hand, and when we talk, you tell me I'm your man. You know I love those little things that I hear, the little things you whisper in my ear. I know there ain't nobody else like you, no one could do the little things you do. Little things that you do make me glad I'm in love with you. Little things that you say make me glad that I feel this way. When we walk, you like to hold my hand, and when we talk, you tell me I'm your man. You know I love those little things that I hear, the little things you whisper in my ear. I know there ain't nobody else like you, no one could do the little things you do.
That was Little Things, and I am Ronnie Allen, and we're going to move to a record right now that didn't become a huge hit, but I've always liked it. It's called Broomstick Cowboy. Came out in 1965.
I think that was one of the best records I ever made. It's actually a song I wrote about my son, who was only 6 months old at the time, and I had put it in a drawer. I just wrote it as a poem and put it away and forgot about it for about a year or two, and came across the poem, and I decided to put a melody to it, and I played it for Jack Gold, and he just absolutely loved it, so we went in and recorded it. And by the time the record came out, a lot of radio stations around the country had said, we're not going to play any more songs about the Vietnam War and the protest songs and all this. And it wasn't a protest song. All it was protesting was growing up, you know, having to go to war. You know, it's basically saying one day you're going to have to grow up and go fight for your country. But so many stations would not play it because it talked about the war in there. And the places that played it, just like Detroit, Michigan, it was the number one record there. Within 10 days, it stayed number one for like 6 weeks in a row. There were places all over the country that it just happened. But the majority of stations would not play it. In fact, I went out to do American Bandstand, and Dick Clark said I was going to have to do the other side of the record. I couldn't do Broomstick Cowboy because ABC wasn't going to play any more war songs.
Well, I'm going to play it. It's not going to do you a lot of good necessarily many years later, but I'm going to play it because I like it. This is Bobby Goldsboro and Broomstick Cowboy.
Dream on, little broomstick cowboy, of rocket ships and Mars, of sunny days and Willie Mays and chocolate candy bars. Dream on, little broomstick
classic cowboy. Dream while you can of big green frogs and puppy dogs and castles in the sand. For all too soon you awaken, your toys will all be gone. Your broomstick horse will ride away to find another home. And you'll have grown into a man with cowboys of your own. And then you'll have to go to war to try and save your home. And then you'll have to learn to hate. You'll have to learn to kill. It's always been that way, my son. I guess it always will. No broomstick gun they'll hand you. No longer you'll pretend. You'll call some man your enemy. You used to call him friend. And when the rocket thunders, you'll hear your brothers cry. And through it all you'll wonder just why they had to die. So dream on, little broomstick cowboy. Dream while you can, for soon you'll be a dreadful thing, my son. You'll be a man.
See the funny little clown and Little Things and Broomstick Cowboy. Three songs that were very different from one another. You had like different styles of songwriting.
Yeah. In fact, that goes back to, like I said, growing up as a kid listening to everything and not knowing there was a difference. Because, you know, I just enjoyed, I know we're going to talk about the painting in a little while, but it's the same thing with the painting. I like to paint all kinds of things. I don't stick to just one thing, and it's the same thing with music. If I get an idea for a song, I never know which way it's going to go. It may turn out to be a ballad, or it may turn out to be a blues song. That's the fun part of songwriting.
In the year 1966, you recorded one of your two famous autumn hits. It's a song called Blue Autumn. It got to number 35. And did you write this one?
I wrote it in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I was in a hotel room, and it was snowing outside. So I don't know why I got the idea for Blue Autumn in the middle of a snowstorm in Pittsburgh, but that's where I wrote it.
Well, I could figure that out. It was snowing, and you weren't thrilled that it was snowing, and you were longing for a blue autumn.
There you go.
Autumn, falling leaves of red and gold, pretty colors I am told, but I see only shades of blue, because I'm losing you. Autumn, there's a rainbow in the sky, but no matter how I try, I still see only shades of blue, because I'm losing you. Such pretty colors, I am told, there for all to see. But falling leaves of red and gold have all turned blue to me. Blue autumn, love like yours I'll never know. other girls may come and go, but I'll see only shades of you. And all my autumns will be blue.
You know, Bobby, as I listen to these songs, the thing that impresses me, your voice is so distinctive.
I appreciate that. It's funny that to hear me, when I record something and hear the playback, it sounds like I think I sound. But when I watch a playback of me on television, like on a Tonight Show or something, and I watch it playback, I think I sound like an idiot. I said, I hate to listen to me talking. I half the time I can't understand me. I say, I talk too fast, or I...
Not at all. When you... Well, hopefully you will listen to this interview, and you're going to be surprised. It's going to be... I'm going to make you sound great.
Fantastic.
I'm going to slow you down.
Great. Put it on 33.
I'm going to put it on 33, and you're going to sound absolutely normal. No, you're very articulate. This is great, and I'm enjoying doing this with you. And
thank you.
After a few records that didn't quite set the world on fire, you needed something to kind of, like, jumpstart your career. Bobby Russell wrote a song, and somewhere along the line, you got to record that song, and the song was Honey. He didn't write it for you.
No, as a matter of fact, he had actually produced a record on Bob Shane, formerly of the Kingston Trio. And Bobby came up to the office one day to play some songs. We were going to do an album. And he played three or four songs in a row that were kind of teeny bopper songs. And I said, don't you have anything? I had already heard the song. Actually, Larry Henley, who sang lead for the New Beat and Bread and Butter and things like that. Larry was a good friend. And he had played Honey for Me by Bob Shane. And it just didn't really do anything for me because it was so overproduced and I missed a lot of the lyrics and it just didn't hit me. So after Bobby Russell had played three or four songs, I said, don't you have anything? What about like the song you just did with Bob Shane, Honey? He says, well, that's coming out next week as a single. I said, well, why don't you play that? Let me hear that. Played it on with just the guitar, and it just blew us away. So we said, can we cut that? And he said, well, it's coming out next week as a single. We said, well, we'll cut it for the album. So about 3 days later, we were in there recording, and the very first take, we went in to listen to the playback, and all the musicians got up and came in to listen to the playback. There's violin players and the piano player and everybody, which I'd never seen done. We just listened to it. It was like a perfect record. So we said, well, let's go cut it again. So we went back and recorded it again and to try to improve it, and it was exactly the same. So we knew we had something special. I had no idea it was going to do what it did, but we called Bobby from the studio and said, listen, we just cut a smash with this. We want to come out with this. He said, well, the Shane record comes out tomorrow, I think it was, or the next day, and he says, why don't you give me 2 weeks with that, and if nothing happens, come with yours. So the record company, when they first heard it, they immediately said, this is going to be a big, big record. So they started pressing the record, and we did give them 2 weeks with the Shane record to the day, and they shipped mine, and luckily I had the hit with it. The arrangement on my record, Don Tweedy, who has since passed away, he wrote the arrangement. It was his idea to have the high voice, like an angel, the lady, and beautiful arrangement, the string lines and all of that. That was all Don Tweedy. So I was just extremely fortunate to have that record.
See the tree, how big it's grown, but friend, it hasn't been too long, it wasn't big. I laughed at her and she got mad, the first day that she planted it was just a twig. Then the first snow came and she ran out to brush the snow away so it wouldn't die. Came running in, all excited, slipped and almost hurt herself, and I laughed till I cried. She was always young at heart, kinda dumb and kinda smart, and I loved her so. And I surprised her with a puppy, kept me up all Christmas Eve, 2 years ago. And it would sure embarrass her when I came in from working late, 'cause I would know that she'd been sitting there and crying over some sad and silly late, late show. And honey, I miss you. and I'm being good. And I'd love to be with you if only I could. She wrecked the car and she was sad and so afraid that I'd be mad. But what the heck? Though I pretended hard to be, guess you could say she saw through me and hugged my neck. I came home unexpectedly and caught her crying needlessly in the middle of the day. And it was in the early spring when flowers bloom and robins sing, she went away. And honey, I miss you, and I'm being good. And I'd love to be with you if only I could. One day while I was not at home, while she was there and all alone, the angels came. Now all I have is memories of honey, and I wake up nights and call her name. Now my life's an empty stage where honey lived and honey played. Small cloud passes overhead and cries down on the flower bed that honey loves. And see the tree, how big it's grown, but friend, it hasn't been too long, it wasn't big. And I laughed at her and she got mad, the first day that she planted it was just a twig.
It's a record that still gets played very, very often, and it was a number one hit in the United States, number one pop hit, number one country hit, number one adult contemporary. It was also a big hit around the world.
It was the largest selling record in the world for 1968. In fact, I was in France doing a song festival, and they came out and gave me a special award, and they translated it, and it was for having the largest selling single in the entire world for that year. It outsold the Beatles and everybody else. As much as people joke about, it's one of the worst songs I've ever heard, we should all have songs like that that people hate if they're going to be the biggest selling records in the world.
So how do you follow up, honey? You follow it with a song that is kind of like in a similar vein. Autumn of My Life. Did you write Autumn of My Life?
I wrote it, and as a matter of fact, I actually wrote it before Honey. In fact, though, so many people think that the husband is dying in the song, but it's actually a song about divorce.
In the spring of my life, she came to me. She brought sunshine where the winds had blown. Then I took her for my wife in the spring of my life. And she brought me a joy I'd never known. And the years, they went by in the spring of my life. And in summer, she blessed me with a child. Love continued to grow in the summer of my life. And in every morning sun, I saw her smile. But in the autumn of my year, I noticed the tears, and I knew that our life was in the past. Though I tried to pretend I knew it was the end. For the autumn of my life had come at last. Now what do you say to a child of 10? How do you tell him his daddy's gone away? Do I tell him that I reached the autumn of my life, and that he understands some winter's day? Now a rose can't be found on a snow-covered ground, and the sun cannot shine through cloudy skies. But I'm richer, you see, for the years she gave to me, and I'm content in the autumn of my life.
Autumn of My Life got to number 19. Before we watch Scotty grow, I do have to ask you about this. I remember when I was growing up and admiring your records, I remember reading this article in one of the tabloids, I believe, and it said that you are very accident prone, and in fact you even cut your toe on a Kellogg's cornflake.
Actually, it was a Rice Krispie.
Oh, it was a Rice Krispie? I'll take that back. Take it to it. Rice Krispie, ladies and gentlemen. I think you just always were accident prone.
You know what? I never really got hurt until I was in high school and had a PE class one day. I was running full speed to catch a football, and I ran into a light pole. Full speed, and I don't think I've been quite right since, because I don't know what caused it, but I've been accident prone. I do dumb things. The Rice Krispie thing, I would go in every morning when I had a little apartment in Nashville before I got my house built, and I was still living in Alabama, and I would go in every morning and get a bowl of Rice Krispies and sit there and watch the Mike Douglas show.
Uh-huh.
Well, one morning I spilled some Rice Krispies in the carpet, and I thought I got everything up, but a couple of them stayed in the carpet, and hardened overnight, obviously, because I came in the next morning as I slid my foot across the carpet. I sliced the bottom of my toe, and I looked down. It was bleeding. I looked to see what it was. It was a Rice Krispie. So
incredible.
If you can do that, you can do anything. Well, I'll tell you what. I started doing things in my senior year. I broke my hand the first day of basketball practice. I threw a ball from one end of the court to the other. I never saw it coming. It hit my finger and shoved it back into my hand and broke it really bad. And then I spiked myself playing baseball my senior year. A guy slid in a second, and my leg flew up, and I spiked myself, sliced the back of my knee, and had to have stitches. And I got hit in the face three different times with a line drive in baseball. I was on the deck circle, and a guy hit a line drive, and I looked around, and he hits me flush in the face. So it's been like that ever since. I do dumb things, though, falling over coffee tables and stuff like that.
You don't have any of these things happen, though, while you're doing a performance, right?
I don't, because I stay in one spot on stage. I rarely move around. Because if I did, I'd probably fight. One time I did it, I walked off stage, and these two girls who sang with me, I let them do a song, and they turn all the lights out, and I'm on stage in the pitch dark trying to find my way backstage and tripped over a speaker and crawled all the way to the curtains till I get, you know. So to this day, I go out and get my spot on stage, and then I don't move around too much.
Bobby, right now I have to ask you an important question. What does BRLFQ spell?
Mom and Dad.
You had to think about it.
I had to think about the lyrics to get
I know you didn't write the song, but you certainly turned Watching Scotty Grow into your own song, and it was written by a very well-known songwriter.
Mac Davis.
Did you get the song again through Bob Montgomery?
No, I was actually in a clothing store in California, and a friend of mine came in who was a record producer, Jerry Fuller, and he was actually producing Andy Williams at the time, and he said, I was just talking about you the other day. Do you know Mac Davis? I said, well, I know who he is. I never met him. He said, well, Mac played a song for me for Andy Williams called Watching Scotty Grow, and I said, I just don't think it's right for Andy, but that sounds like a good song for Bobby Goldsboro. He said, you ought to give Mac a call and have him play it for you. So he gave me Mac's phone number, and I went back to the hotel and called him, and Mac ended up coming over to the hotel, and we just hit it off because we had so many mutual friends, and we sat around for 2 or 3 hours playing songs, and I said, well, play me this song, Watching Scotty Grow, and he played it for me, and I loved it. I said, well, my son's name is Danny. Can I call it Watching Danny Grow? He says, oh, man, my son would leave if we changed the name of it. So I left it, Watching Scotty Grow, went back and recorded it, and it became a top 10 hit for me.
There he sits with a pen and a yellow pad. What a handsome lad. That's my boy. B-R-L-F-Q spells mom and dad. Well, that ain't too bad, but that's my boy. Well, you can have your TV and your nightclubs, and you can have your driving picture shows. I'll stay here with my little man near. We'll listen to the radio, bide my time and watching Scotty grow. Making a castle out of building blocks and a cardboard box, that's my boy. Mickey Mouse says it's 13 o'clock. Well, that's quite a shock, but that's my boy. In 4 short years, I've gone from rags to riches. And what I did before that, I don't know. So let it rain on my windowpane. I got my own rainbow. And we're sitting here shining, watching Scotty grow. Riding on Daddy's shoulders, off to bed. Old sleepy head, that's my boy. Gotta have a drink of water and a story read. A teddy bear named Fred, that's my boy. What that you say, Mama? Come on and keep your feet warm. Well, save me a place, I'll be there in a minute or so. I think I'll stay right here and say a little prayer before I go. Me and God are watching Scotty grow. Me and God are watching Scotty grow.
That was Watching Scotty Grow, great Mac Davis song. So Bobby wrote a lot of his own hits. And he also had the good sense to record songs that other well-known songwriters did as well. You've had a very varied career.
It wasn't that I wanted to write everything myself. A lot of times I did it out of necessity. I felt like I didn't have a hit song at the time, but any time somebody came up with something I thought was a hit, we definitely cut it. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have Honey or Watching Scotty Grow or The Straight Life. So.
Exactly. The next song that we're going to talk about is one that you wrote and has been recorded by a lot of different people. I know you released it, I believe, as a single in 72, but so many other people did it. Did you write the song in 72 or had you written it?
No, I wrote it back in 68, I think it was.
68.
But when I wrote it, in fact, I haven't told a lot of people this, but I actually wrote it about Roger Miller. Roger was a good friend and Roger was getting divorced. When he told me about it, I started thinking, that's going to be awful. I knew him and his wife real well, and I had stayed with him before, and I started thinking. So the more I thought about it, I got the idea for the song, and I wrote it. But when I recorded it, it was actually, I should think it was in the Honey album, I believe. Bob Montgomery, who was my co-producer, called and said he was producing Johnny Darrell, who was a country singer, and said Johnny is going to be dropped from the label if he doesn't have a hit. And he could have a hit with Pen in Hand. I said, yeah, but that's going to be my next single after. He says, you got to let us record this or he's going to be dropped.
Wow.
So I let him record it, and he had a number one country record with it. But then I said, well, I'll wait a while, and then I can come out with it later. Well, then I think Jerry Vale had recorded and had an easy listening hit.
What female artist recorded it?
Vicky Carr.
Vicky Carr
had a huge hit with it. And then Billy Vera cut it.
Billy Vera did a great version.
So it was recorded over 100 times, and every time I said, well, now I think it's been long enough, I can release it. Well, somebody else would come out with it. So finally, it took several years before they released my version of it.
Well, let me tell you something, Bobby. This song, every time I hear the song, it brings a lump to my throat. It's just such a touching song.
Well, I tell you, Vicky Carr, every time she sings it, she'll tell you to this day she can't get through the song without crying. And when she did my TV show every season, she'd come out and do it, and she'd say before the show, and I'm going to get through it this time. I've done the song enough. And she would start crying every time.
We're going to listen to it right now. This is Bobby Goldsboro's version of his original composition called With Pen in Hand.
With pen in hand, you sign your name. Today at 5, I'll be on that train, and you'll be free, and I will be alone, so alone. If you think we can't find the love we once knew, if you think I can't make everything up to you, then I'll be gone and you'll be on your own. You'll be on your own. Can you take good care of Johnny? Can you take him to school every day? Can you teach him how to catch a fish and keep all those bullies away? Hear what I say. Can you teach him how to whistle a tune? Can you tell him about the man in the moon? If you can do these things, then maybe he won't miss me. Maybe he won't miss me. And tonight, as you lay in that big lonely bed, can you look at the pillow where I laid my head? With your heart on fire, will you have no desire to kiss me and to hold me? And if you can forget the good time we had, if you think that the good times don't outweigh the bad, then sign your name and I'll be on my way. I'll be on my way.
By the way, With Pen in Hand has gotten like a million plays. It's a member of that Millionaires Club.
Yeah, it's songs that are actually played over a million times on the radio. It's a nice company to be in because there's a lot of great songs in there, and I've got a couple of Autumn of My Life is also in there. That's nice to know that your songs are getting played like that.
We have one more song to play, which we're going to close off the interview with, but as I said at the beginning of the show, I don't want to complete this interview without mentioning your other things that you do. Like, for example, you're an accomplished painter as well as a TV producer. So in 15 seconds or less, just tell me about the painting and the TV. In other words, you're non-musical.
I've always wanted to paint, and I sketched a little in high school, and then I got into the music and put everything on the back burner. But over the years, my wife and I would go to museums or galleries and look at paintings, and I would say, well, I really want to do that one day, and I kept putting it off, and she kept saying, when are you going to paint? When are you going to paint? So finally I said, when I turn 65, I'll start painting. Well, 3.5 years ago, I turned 65. So I went and bought the canvases, the paints, and everything, and I absolutely love it, and every waking minute of the day, I'm painting. In fact, you can go to BobbyGoldsboro.com website and see all the paintings. We sold 80-something pieces of art this past year, and I've done 5 one-man shows. I've got 2 more shows coming up this fall, and I'm just absolutely loving it. And the painting, to me, like I said earlier, is the same as songwriting. I don't just paint one thing. I paint whatever's out there. There's so many beautiful things in the world that I hate to just stick with one thing, like all flowers or all landscapes or things like that. So I paint a little of everything, and it's in oils, and I just absolutely love it. So you can go on the website and see all the paintings, and we sell prints of the paintings. A lot of the paintings are fairly expensive, and if somebody says they love a certain painting but it's too big for their wall, well, you can do the prints. And the state of the art now, it's all done on canvas, and it looks just like the original, and they're much less expensive, and you can have them done in different sizes. I absolutely love it.
So it's not too much of a stretch to assume that at least somebody out there might own an original Gainsboro and an original Goldsboro.
There you go.
From 1973 to 1975, you hosted a syndicated television variety series. You spent a lot of time trying to come up with the name of the show, and you finally settled on the Bobby Goldsboro Show.
A weird name for a show. It was a lot of fun. In fact, it was the highest-rated syndicated variety show on television for the 3 years. But after 3 years, I realized I wasn't getting to songwrite anymore, wasn't getting to do that many concerts. I was strictly working on the TV series. And although it did a world of good for me, recognition-wise and career-wise, it just got to the point where I felt like I don't want to just keep doing this year after year after year because I'm not getting to do a lot of the other things I want to do. And by then, I wanted to write more, and I had wanted to write children's stories, and I just didn't have the time. So I said, well, if we stop the show while it's at its peak, I could always do it later maybe, but if I wait till the show starts losing ratings, well then, you know.
Exactly.
Then, so that's why we stopped.
But you did start writing some children's stories, right?
Yeah, and matter of fact, I've got 12 children's books out now, and I've done 4 animated specials for the Disney Channel, and then I did a series that I always wanted to do that I created called The Swamp Critters of Lost Lagoon. We have now filmed 52 half-hour episodes, and I helped create the animatronics that go into the mouth movement so I could control the mouth movements of every character. I do all the voices, and I wrote 4 or 5 songs for every show, so I've written about 150 songs.
You also produced the show?
Yeah, I produced it, and I wrote every episode, so it was a very time-consuming thing to do. It's the most work I've ever done, but it's the most fun I've ever had doing anything. And we were on the Learning Channel and PBS, and now we're on Dish Network. We're on Sky Angel and TBN, and we're all over the world with the show, and we're in, like, South Africa and Spain, and so we've got a whole line of products with talking dolls and DVDs and videos and all kinds of stuff.
And people that want to learn more about what you're doing, and it seems like it's changing by the minute, can visit your website, www.bobbygoldsboro.com.
Correct.
Bobby, I want to acknowledge one thing before we close with Summer the first time, and that is, in addition to your incredible pop music career, when you got into the 70s, you were heavily into country music, and one of these days, maybe in the future, we can do an interview about your country songs. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Because you did so many of those. We'll mention a few of the titles that you did on the country field. You did Muddy Mississippi Line, We Gotta Start Lovin', and then A Butterfly for Bucky. I think I'm going to run A Butterfly for Bucky as a bonus track so people can hear that along with Trusty Little Herbert.
All right.
But you did have quite a few. You also wrote one that Brenda Lee eventually did, I think, as The Cowboy and the Dandy. And
I wrote it as The Cowboy and the Lady. Brenda did it in... Dolly Parton did it in her album, and John Denver recorded it. It's been recorded quite a few times.
Bobby, thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking the time to do this. I want to wish you all the success in the world with your future endeavors. Of course, if you weren't doing this interview, you would have painted another picture. But you got plenty of time for that.
It's been my pleasure. It really has.
Now, Summer the First Time is what we're going to close with. And this song, I know it was voted somewhere as the top summertime song of all time. I think
In England.
In England.
Yeah.
I assume you wrote this?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I wrote it. And I've been asked a million times if I wrote it from personal experience, and I always say it's none of your business.
and you could take that any way you want. But I'm not going to ask you to describe the song. I think the best thing is for people who are familiar with it, they'll love to hear it again. And for those who are not familiar with it, it's quite a song, ladies and gentlemen. Bobby, thanks again. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Bobby Goldsboro closing the show with Summer the First Time.
was a hot afternoon, the last day of June, and the sun was a demon. The clouds were afraid, one tin in the shade, and the pavement was steaming. I told Billy Ray in his red Chevrolet, I needed time for some thinking. I was just walking by when I looked in her eyes, and I swore it was winking. She was 31 and I was 17. I knew nothing about love, she knew everything. But I sat down beside her on a front porch swing, wondered what the coming night would bring. We sat on the sand and the boy took her hand, but I saw the sun rise as a man. Ten years have gone by since I looked in her eyes, but the memory lingers. I go back in my mind to the very first time I feel the touch of her fingers. Was a hot afternoon, the last day of June, and the sun was a demon. The clouds were afraid, one tin in the shade.
We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
Well, that's the show. And now a couple of bonus tracks by Bobby Goldsboro. Unlike most of the songs you heard on this particular show, these two are up-tempo. First one is a song written by Sonny Curtis. He wrote and sang the Mary Tyler Moore theme, and he also wrote I Fought the Law, big hit by the Bobby Fuller Four. And he wrote this hit record for Bobby Goldsboro. This one got to number 36 on the chart. Here's Bobby doing The Straight Life.
Sometimes I imagine myself as a drifter, seeker of fortune, connoisseur of great wine, dashing through meadows of yellow and green, trying to catch the impossible dream, leaving the straight life behind. Sometimes my thoughts may find me in Mexico, drinking tequila, going out of my mind, having a ball on a couple of bars, treating the ladies to corn on the cob, leaving the straight life behind. Suddenly all my silly thoughts disappear. She comes to me softly with crackers and beer, winking and blinking and blowing my ear, running away with my mind. It's great to be in love, I'm not really thinking of leaving the straight life behind. I'm just playing a game in my mind. Do 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 do. Once in a while in my mind I go bumming, going to nowhere with no worry of time, running along chasing after a train, humming a song in the sun and the rain, leaving the straight life behind. I can just see me on a tropical island, riding the surf and drinking coconut wine, having me fun with golden girls in the sand, chasing the sun through an innocent land, leaving the straight life behind. Suddenly all my silly thoughts disappear. She comes to me softly with crackers and beer, winking and blinking and blowing my ear, running away with my mind. It's great
to be in love. I'm not really thinking of leaving the straight life behind. I'm just playing a game in my mind. Do 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 do.
And finally, we have a kind of an interesting song by Bobby. This never became a hit, but it's one of my personal favorites. And it's about an accountant who didn't quite live up to his name. And I bet you never heard this song before. Trusty Little Herbert.
Trusty Little Herbert goes to work at 8. For the last long 20 years he never has been late. He works for a great big bank. He has gained respect. Keeps their records up to date. They never have to check. Little Mary Sellers, she's one of the tellers. And just like all the fellers, Herbert thinks she's well. Trusty little Herbert buys her ice cream sherbet. He's in love with her, but he can't catch her eye. She's in love with Amos, 'cause he is rich and famous, and he can buy her things that Herbert cannot buy. Trusty little Herbert said this just won't work. How can I hope to win her hand when I am just a clerk? I've got to get some money, and I have just a plan. One mistake is all it takes, just one slip of my hand. $100,000 surely does sound swell, and I can fix it so no one can tell. Trusty little Herbert buys her ice cream sherbet. He's in love with her, but he can't catch her eye. She's in love with Amos, 'cause he is rich and famous, and he can buy her things that her cannot buy. Trusty little Herbert took his trusty pen, added up the list and where the total should have been. 10 big shiny numbers standing in a line. Herbert wrote the total down, but there were only 9. Herbert took the money and kneeled at Mary's feet. She took the money from his hand and said, "You're very sweet." The next day in the paper, read where she had gone. She had married Amos and they'd left for parts unknown. Trusty little Herbert, he'd made just one mistake, and they gave him 50 years to get it straight.